Welcome to Sea Control, your moment of PowerPoint rehab from the Center for International Maritime Security. This is our third episode. Our guest today is Dustin Walker, founder and head editor of Real Clear Defense. We will be discussing Tom Clancy and his legacy, the government shutdown and its effects on defense, our upcoming Sacred Cows Week, African security issues, Iran's nuclear weapons program, and a bit about technology and innovation. Sit back and enjoy the show. Welcome, everyone, to the third edition of Sea Control. I'm here with Dustin Walker, the founding editor of Real Clear Defense, one of the many websites in the vast Real Clear Politics empire, something that a lot of us follow, a lot of good articles on there. Maybe once in a while an article from SimSec. I don't know. Those are the best ones. Welcome, Dustin.
Thanks for having me.
All right, so top of the block here is lots of stuff happened this week. We got Syria, we've got government shutdown, but most importantly and most depressingly, we have the loss of a scion, or a scion? No, scion's not the word. What's the word I'm looking for? Of American literature, and that is Tom Clancy. So that is rather depressing. We lost Michael Crichton. Now Tom Clancy is gone. Once Clive Cussler is gone, I don't know what I'm supposed to do in the realm of fiction.
There will be no books to read.
Yeah, there will be officially no more books to read anywhere. I don't know. Dustin, I'm assuming you're familiar with Tom Clancy. We all are. We all went to Georgetown, so we're all a bunch of defense nerds. What was your first introduction to Tom Clancy?
The first introduction was watching The Hunt for Red October, but after that, when I realized that there were books behind those movies, I read most of his most famous books when I was in school, and it was part of, coming to know and love the U.S. military and the intelligence community was from reading his books, and I know that that's true for so many people, so.
Yeah, I gotta say, when I was reflecting on it, the fact that yet another author that I love is gone and can produce no more books, I was thinking about his influence, and maybe he subconsciously led me kind of onto the Navy side of things. But I remember the first book I read, because I didn't know Hunt for Red October was a book. I just thought that was a movie, because I'm a kid and I'm dumb. I'm like, oh, cool movie. They don't make books out of these. Was Rainbow Six, because that was just ridiculous. Because people just going around doing whatever the hell they wanted. But my favorites have got to be Executive Orders and Cardinal of the Kremlin. Maybe not the most conventional ones, but Executive Orders, because Jack Ryan does what he wants, which should have been the alternative title. And Cardinal of the Kremlin, because... Yeah, Cardinal of the Kremlin was just had SDI, it had spies, guys getting kidnapped, and Russian guys betraying the Soviet Union, which is already always good. And, that was my favorite. I was thinking, though, what are your thoughts on Clear and Present Danger? Because I actually think that book has a lot to do with all the Bradley Manning stuff and Ed Snowden. Like, that's what everyone wishes was happening.
Yeah. I mean, I've heard people trying to draw that parallel, but I try and not allow Bradley Manning or Edward Snowden to ever come into any...
Oh, yeah.
Any kind of positive light, so
exactly.
Even bringing Clear and Present Danger into it is,
I was thinking beforehand, and I was like, man, I love the movie Clear and Present Danger, I love the book, and I was like, yeah, but he's like a whistleblower, like, no, but he's a real one, like, he has something that he points and blows, he's not just like, hey, man, I don't like the government, bro, and information is free, and let me tell everybody everything, and just like, come on,
right. And he's also someone that, I think, having been in that position, would have accepted the responsibility for what he was doing, even if he thought it was right, then he would have accepted the consequences.
Exactly.
What you can't say about.
Yeah. What would you say? I guess let's go on a little side. Bradley Manning, Ed Snowden. Since we're on the topic, why would people assume these guys? Because I don't get it. Like, is it just the media comes out and says, hey, NSA is doing scary stuff, and we just assume it, and then we go, okay, hero, and then everything that comes out afterwards, well, doesn't matter? Or why is it that these two guys at least have such a strong, I don't want to call them a cabal, but just a group of people that are just bound and determined to show that they're heroes?
Well, I think that there's sort of a a bigger narrative beyond Manning and Snowden that, I mean, the Obama administration has been criticized by some people for being very harsh on people who are releasing a lot of information. Mm-hmm. And let's face it, I mean, we do live in an era now in a post-9/11 world where there is a ton of stuff that is classified that probably really shouldn't be. So you have that, plus you have an environment where anyone who talks about that information is being prosecuted. So when you get two people like this that really reveal a lot of things, including some stuff that people would consider to be wrongdoing, I think there's a huge effort to prevent those people from being, taken completely to task in the public, because they don't want that to be the end of the conversation. I mean, if Bradley Manning and Edward Snowden just go gently into the good night, I don't think many people are going to feel very comfortable about coming out with information in the future. So they're really battling for, overall, just the right of people to talk about this stuff.
That's true. I guess that's the thin line, is that you've got that's what kills me, too, is because there is a legitimate place for whistleblowing. If something's going wrong and no one's listening to you, there is a right place and time. So I would take an oath to the Constitution and not, a government or an official. That's why. But then you've got someone who comes out and acts like a clown and says, here's 80 gigabytes of information. You're like, cool, what is it about? And you're like, I don't know.
Yeah. And
just sift through it. Find something.
The other line is, if you think that there is serious wrongdoing, there's a crime being committed. I think,
Yeah, you have an obligation.
Why that someone would come forward and talk about that, and I think we would hope that that would be the case. But it's another thing when you're saying, well, I don't really like what's going on, or I disagree with this program or policy, and now I'm going to just throw
all the difference
out there because I think I'm so important.
I was thinking about one thing. Is the report that came out as they were sifting through all the data, the NSA guys that were looking on their love interests?
12 people in a decade.
Have you seen the movie True Lies? That's it! The movie, every American loves the movie True Lies, and Arnold Schwarzenegger is 100% doing exactly what the NSA is doing, which is using the vague and threatening government agencies' assets to spy on his wife. And you're like, before I got into the military, I'm like, yeah, this is pretty cool. Afterwards, when I'm thinking, I've done supply, I've kind of done some accounting things, I'm like, wow, how do you not get fired? Like, this is really just waste, fraud, and abuse happening. I mean, granted, it saves America from a nuclear attack, but...
Yeah, well, I mean, I do have to say about that. I mean, any of these NSA stories and violations and all that stuff, over a 10-year period, 12 people did that, and every single one of them was caught and reprimanded. So, to be fair, they've taken a lot of heat for stuff of late. I mean, that's a pretty minimal violation record.
Now, one thing before we jump on this complete segue away from Tom Clancy that we did here, but I noticed on Real Clear Defense, I saw a really neat article, The Decline of the Military Loved, about in the Weekly Standard. About Tom Clancy. I guess, and it brings up an interesting point I was thinking about, is did Tom Clancy did he create, because he's a big figure in American authorship, did he create the modern day image of this Leviathan of American military power? Or, because it feels like in the 90s that all the stuff that I read about when I was a little kid, it was Tom Clancy, military's invincible, it can do everything. How much did he have a part in I don't want to call it mission creep, but that American switch from the post-Vietnam military where everybody's has a problem with the military, there are a lot of internal issues.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if I would go as far to describe it as, the Leviathan, that anybody can do anything, but I mean, it's important to remember that.
While I was a kid, that's what I thought.
Tom Clancy started writing these books, and they became popular in the 80s.
Right.
He was really the first, author or filmmaker or any person that had, wide cultural influence who started to portray the military in any kind of competent or positive light. I mean, think about all the movies that were coming out.
Oh, yeah.
Before that, Platoon or any of those kinds of things where it's the, soldiers going out and killing innocent people, and it's still very heavily influenced by Vietnam. And then in the middle of the Reagan buildup, where we're trying to get away from a hollow military, which it absolutely was, and the military was in disarray in the 1970s. Here comes Tom Clancy writing about the capabilities of this military in an extremely accurate light. So it was both popular within the military and it was readable by everybody on the outside. I mean, had huge influence to the point that, Reagan himself was reading October and couldn't go to sleep. So yeah, I mean, he had a huge influence.
Did you see the USNI news article about the mobile missile launchers on the hovercraft?
No.
He apparently at some point in time, they were worried like, oh man, do we have a survivable second strike capability? And his idea was, hey, instead of putting our missiles in huge deep bunkers, just put them on hovercraft. And then if something goes off, they'll just scatter to the winds.
I was
like, wow, that's so apparently they did calculations and they're like, yeah, you can get within a 2,000 square mile radius, so no one can hit you. You just drive away in a flurry. I mean, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, it did get to the point that Clancy was writing about, what was already existing technology and explaining how it worked, to the point that then people wanted to know what kind of future kinds of things he had in mind.
Talking about nuclear missiles, I'm going to show my path to this segue. Talking about nuclear missiles, MX missiles at one point in time, their funding caused a government shutdown. We're now in a government shutdown, which is obviously, boom, topic of the week. Nice fade to the next topic. I call it a nice fade on. It's kind of ugly to probably everybody else. But You're the real clear defense guy. You spend all week doing nothing but absorbing articles about the military. Your perspective on what's happening when it comes to capability or long-term effects or even short-term stuff that's happening in the military right now due to the shutdown.
Well, I mean, I don't mean to be pessimistic, but I mean, whether it's short-term, medium-term, long-term, I think that the atmosphere in D.C. is having tremendous negative impacts. Short term, there was something I saw this week. There was a Marine three-star talking about how they just, between the cuts and the furloughs and the shutdown, I mean, they just don't have the capability to do all this huge backlog of equipment maintenance that we have that's critical. I mean, we're trying to reset this force that comes home from Afghanistan and get ready for the future, and we just can't do it. I wrote an article about the Air Force Base.
I saw that, yeah.
Down in Boise, where now the only jets flying at the Air Force Base are foreign.
The jets. Was Luftwaffe and you said Singapore?
Yeah, there's an F-15 squadron from Singapore that is based in at Mountain Home Air Force Base in Idaho, and then there are German and Canadian jets doing.
Okay, I really read the part. German.
No U.S. jets can fly because they've been grounded due to the shutdown. And I mean, we're basically starving readiness in order to pay. We're starving long-term readiness to pay for short-term things. If you're deploying before January, you get to train, but after that, you're just kind of sitting there. That kind of thing's really dangerous. That accumulates.
Yeah.
You don't get that kind of thing back if you do it for a long time. So I'm very, very concerned. And you see, sort of as a more medium and long-term consideration, you see a lot of things where the Pentagon's cutting. We're considering cutting a lot of programs that people say have been very good, affordable, successful programs. The latest example being the A-10, which I think anyone who's ever...
The what? I'm sorry?
The A-10 Warthog.
Oh, yeah, that's insane.
Yeah, I mean, and basically what the Pentagon's point is, hey, it's easier for us to cut single mission things and just get rid of it all because it's sort of a clean cut for us. Yet the problem is if you're anyone who's ever needed close air support in Afghanistan or something, the A-10 was your best friend.
It's all air-mindedness, and the A-10 takes the Air Force near the dirty people in brown and green, and they're like, whoa, that's really low down to the ground. I don't want to go near you folks. So the A-10, I was telling my buddy in the Army, it's like, hey, the Air Force has what? 5,000 some aircraft? I guess the Navy and the Army maybe they each need 2,500 new aircraft and they can go find something else to do.
Exactly. Well, to bring it closer to home for the Navy folks, the Chief of Naval Operations was up up on the Hill not too long ago, talking about, you know, what are you going to do between sequester cuts and 14, all that kind of stuff. I mean, basically his point was, well, we're going to protect the Ohio replacement ballistic missile sub. But outside of that, we're pretty much not going to be able to protect much.
The stuff that I've been seeing like on the ground, and you know, I'm not out in the field. We got back from deployment, but the big problems are, I mean, we're still getting our paycheck, so the bill went. I know they're still negotiating it, but you know, we're still getting our paychecks, which is good. You know, I know some people question, hey, is it good that there's a special group that's still getting their paycheck? You know, I hope everybody still gets their paycheck, so I don't want to see, you know, these enlisted guys or officers out there trying to do stuff and not having pay. I mean, that's bad for anyone, you know. But the stuff that's really irritating to a lot of people is you've got travel orders, you've got bonuses, you've got people going from one place to another. All those people, personnel support detachments, they're all furloughed. So when it comes to, hey, how do I process my travel orders? Maybe you're lucky enough to have a military staffed administration debt, but maybe you don't. Maybe your short side command, they're all civilians. So do you pay for it yourself? Do you wait at your old command? I know apparently 60% of the Naval Academy professors have been furloughed, and I know they've been real hard on this. And, you know, a lot of people talk about, hey, why can't people volunteer their time? And on one side, you know, I'm 100% for that. I'm saying, hey, if you want to volunteer, that's your own business. But somebody did bring up the fact that there is a law about this that says that if you're not being funded, it can, and everyone's saying, oh, you could go to jail. I don't think the law says that. That's not, someone's not coming out and saying, hey, I'm going to send you to jail. But that comes more with the practical, people aren't really going to send you to jail. But I think people are more, and this, you know, we have a litigious society. So the question is, I'm glad that you're volunteering now, but am I going to owe you three times overtime at some point? Which, you know, I hate, and I know people out there that really want a contract, but these are, I don't think these people are being vindictive as so much as just trying to watch their back, because they don't want to pay it. They don't want to get it in the rear later and try to pay three and four times when what they thought was volunteering. But, yeah, that's an unfortunate just side effect of our litigious society.
So a couple things. Number one, today, actually just in the last few hours, Secretary Hagel came out and released an order to bring back pretty much all of the DoD civilian workforce starting on Monday.
Really? Everybody that's furloughed, all DoD personnel furloughed on Monday?
Pretty much. There's going to be, I didn't see what the narrow category was that people wouldn't be coming back, but for the most part, DoD civilians will be returning to work on Monday. But you're right that, you know, when you get somebody furloughed, people might be willing to go back in, but they really don't want you to do that. I mean, having served in the government, and we almost shut down in like 2011 when I was there. And,
It was actually a few hours. You know, people
technically it was a few hours.
Yeah.
But they did tell people, you know, if you're get deemed non-essential and you're furloughed, don't come to work because it can potentially cause a lot of problems.
Right.
You're right. It is very litigious, but it is just sort of the way it is. I mean, beyond the Naval Academy or trying to get some administrative stuff taken care of, I mean, I'm glad that these folks are going to be returning to work. But I mean, one of the things I was really concerned with was that during the shutdown, as much as 75% of civilians that work for the intelligence agencies had been furloughed.
I didn't know that. That's a lot.
Yeah, I mean, you had a bunch of people who were providing, I mean, what I would say,
critical intelligence support. Yeah.
Yeah, to folks in the armed forces, and those folks were not going to work. So,
wow.
I mean, that's, yeah, I think that's extremely problematic.
Hopefully
they'll be going back on Monday.
That's true. And, you know, a lot of people talk about, oh, you know, civilian contractors, and they're talking during the furlough. They're like, oh, blah, 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 you know. A lot of these guys maybe get a bad rap. They talk about logistical tail, and this is fat. I remember during the furlough, and, you know, not to say, because I know people, and not to say any names or on what ships or where, but you hear about guys like, you know, engineers and stuff, that they'll show up anyways. They'll say, we got to get this done. You know, they're working out. These guys aren't here to get the paycheck. They're here to help out too. But since we're talking about budget cuts, we're talking about the shutdown. We've got on 4 to 8 November at SimSec, we've got the Sacred Cows Week on Real Clear Defense. I saw you posted a USNI article. Look at all that connectivity. That's fun. About Naval Postgraduate School by Cap McDonald. And it kind of brings in some people question, hey, service academies. I look at it, hey, I went to Georgetown. I got a security studies degree. You know, where else are you going to get something like that? You look at engineering degrees. You've got MIT, Drexel University, lots of other engineering schools. And you wonder, and I realize there are specific stuff, but, you know, Naval Postgraduate School, other kind of programs, what do you see? You know, again, you're a massive supercomputer of articles constantly on defense. Sacred cows, stuff maybe that we need to question our premises on, and stuff maybe we're questioning that we shouldn't, that are really critical.
Yeah, I mean, so I've heard a lot of sort of things around the edges, like, I service academies, people talk about this. I mean, I don't think, you know, we're not getting rid of Annapolis anytime soon, but, you know, when it comes to a lot of sort of the graduate school stuff that's being done, I mean, I know that NDU, National Defense University, has had a lot of cutbacks, and I think that's probably something that's going to continue because since there's a lot of great private options out there,
that's true.
You know, the argument is that maybe it's not as essential to maintain those things, but I mean, you're talking sacred cows, you're talking about budget cuts, the one big, big, big one that is out there that I think is going to dominate the conversation is military compensation. That's the biggest one. And that's everything from pay to TRICARE to all kinds of other healthcare benefits and things like that. That's really the big one. I mean, I've seen numbers, I'll point anyone that wants to go look at it, there was an article in Foreign Affairs by Todd Harrison, who's with the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments. I strongly recommend it, and that article was basically about, a lot of the cuts that are coming down the road. One of the things that he said in there is that basically, on the current track, we don't do something about military compensation. The whole defense budget is going to be eaten up by paying people.
It's true. I think
we're getting things ready by 2024. We're not going to be able to invest in anything. So it's a big problem. It's obviously politically extremely dicey.
I think Hagel brought, Secretary Hagel, after his speech for the SCMR Strategic Choices and Management Review, maybe it was him, maybe it was somebody else, maybe it was General Odierno, I don't remember. Somebody brought up, I think, what did they say, 80%? Maybe that's high. 80%
that's
personnel. Okay, that is who that was then.
80%
that's
of
an insane amount of money. People always talk about, detractors from the military talk about, oh, the military-industrial complex. This money is all being spent on people. Like, that is a lot of money. And I don't think people understand that. When they look at the defense budget, they're like, oh, it's bullets and you're building new ships and tanks. And, like, no, really, that is not
at all
happening.
Yeah, no. So, here, I'll give you a couple. I mean, I might miss these a little bit. But since 2001, you know, you had the defense budget overall went up by over 100%. So went up a lot, and if you ask people what they think that went to, I'm sure they probably think it's because we're buying a bunch of expensive systems and blah, blah, blah. But no, there was a 57% increase in compensation costs. There was a 34% increase just in readiness costs to keep the things that we have existing working.
Mm-hmm.
The Air Force shrank substantially. The average age of the aircraft they have went up.
Mm-hmm.
The TD shrank. We went from, over 300 ships, now we're down around 285, we're on a track to go down to as low as 270.
They cut, personally I'm happy about this, but they did cut the numbers of LCS, because at least the money's going into ships, fewer ships, but at least the money's going to the ships that do stuff.
You don't like those combat modules? But, I mean, look, the narrative about all of the defense budget went up, so now we have to get rid of all this stuff, is, well, that's fine, but you better address the things that actually made it go up.
Right.
Which are, we were fighting a war, we're not going to be fighting those wars anymore.
Right.
We are paying people a lot of money, we haven't done any, and this is not to say that anyone hasn't earned.
Exactly, and that's always the killer. That's the killer, is that these guys did earn it.
Well, But, you know, another way of putting it is this, you know, I think that the people that had volunteered to be in the military obviously are owed, you know, a great debt. Their compensation really should be, you know, beyond question in a way. But because we owe so much to the people that are going to be serving in the future and are going to have to go in harm's way, I want to make sure that they have the best training equipment possible. So that
exactly.
They're safe when they go out. And that's not going to be possible if we don't change military compensation.
And it's an unfortunate and it's true. You look at the guys and you're like, who's more important? And when you say more important, it's not the right way to put it, but it's hard to word it. Is the guy getting shot at or the guy who was getting shot at? And unfortunately, the guy getting shot at right now is the one you have to worry about. I mean, you still have to worry about everybody. Everybody's earned what they earned, but the resource pool is limited, and it all comes down to what you're going to do.
Very difficult.
So, all right. Another, I'm going to do a smooth, no, this is going to be completely not smooth segue. So we've got African Navies Week coming up. That's next week, starts on Monday. I know, Dustin, you were saying you're mainly not so much an Africa guy, but hey, apparently this has been my challenge, getting people to write articles about this, is that no one is, because all the challenges appear to be on the land, but I thought this was an area. We talked about the government shutdown. And we've seen all the articles about so many more people being spent to shut things down than they were to run them, and I thought this was interesting. We talk about, you know, control of fisheries. We've seen Somalia. Fisheries issue becomes piracy, Gulf of Guinea, piracy, and then oil being stolen. These are all governments that are functioning. And you look at Florida Bay. There's been a report recently that the National Park Service has shut down some 1,000-plus square mile piece of the open ocean. And it got me thinking is we're doing this entire week on African navies, where governments that are functioning, governments that are trying to get up on their feet, they're trying to enforce the law out at sea, have less control over spaces of ocean than an institution that has ostensibly been shut down. It's like National Park Services, oh, we're closed, but none of you are getting underway. And it's a testament to the strength of our civil society, I would say, that people don't. Because how are Park Services going to stop? Maybe that's just my ignorance when it comes to how these things are enforced, but how would they stop you in the first place?
Well, if I may, I will spitball one thing about the importance of African navies.
Shoot.
And it goes to something you're talking about now. They're having a tremendously difficult time policing a lot of this. And a lot of this comes down to resources that are under the sea and the fact that, you know, developing those resources is absolutely essential to economic growth in those countries. And they're having an extremely difficult time doing it. And I think it is interesting that there are two things, really, that China has been doing lately on the international stage. One of them is anti-piracy work. And they sent for the first time a contingent of peacekeeping troops to help out. I can't remember which African country it was. They're starting to signal that they're going to want to do this kind of stuff.
That's true.
So we're helping out in Africa right now to try and help police some of these, to combat piracy and protect these resources. But perhaps it won't be too much, too much late to see U.S. and Chinese ships running around in the Gulf.
Well, you know what? I'm glad you brought that up. Obviously, we're going to try to avoid talking about Somalia too much because it's been beat to death by a lot of people. But when I did go to counter-piracy deployments out there, the Chinese were already there.
Yep.
And it was interesting to see the different tactics of different navies. Some people looked for sea control. Some people did convoy operations. And to see that mix and everybody operating all around themselves. And when you look at a lot of different navies that you might see as not direct competitors, but all working together because, I mean, they're pirates. Nobody's on the pirate side, and they're all working together in the same place. That's good. That's good to see. Which is interesting. But and you bring up a good point when it comes to control. Is that, I mean, you and I both know. We both got IR subjects beat to death at Georgetown, and it's all about civil society and how legitimate is the government. And you look at the sea and you're like, okay, so we look at Boko Haram, we look at Al-Shabaab, and they're all – none of these are particularly seaborne groups. They do stuff at the sea, but that's the point, is how big does the vacuum get? And you have to stop it somewhere. So you've got a cocaine industry. You've got like $1.5 billion. I think you got something like $5 to $8 billion leaving Nigeria and stolen oil every year. People just blanket stealing ships using fake charters. And you wonder like how far much farther – if you can stop it at sea, if you have solid maritime security, at least – you help start building that bubble of yeah, like legitimate use of force.
There definitely seems to be a disconnect there because, I mean, if you get anyone who, even an expert about Nigeria talking about the problems, I mean, obviously Boko Haram is the first thing that comes up. But I mean, is Boko Haram costing anywhere? I don't know, but it doesn't seem that they're costing nearly as much money as a lot of this piracy does. And the fact that they've got people, you know, interrupting pipelines and doing all this kind of stuff, that is extremely damaging, and it takes away the resources that the government needs to fight the stuff in the first place.
Exactly, and I think that's the issue. It's violence versus money. Sure, criminal elements are violent, but they take your money, and maybe you don't see that as easily as you see a church getting blown up or a school. I think they had an agricultural school get shot up recently, which is insane. You're like, everybody likes food, right? It's not a very controversial topic. But, you know, Boko Haram, I think their whole name means Western education is forbidden. I mean, like, what's your different version of education? Like, osmosis, you're going to throw the book underneath the pillow and you'll learn about agriculture as you sleep. But is that the more crime exists, the bigger this area of it gives more avenues. They've got Al-Shabaab. I don't know if you heard about this. Al-Shabaab is in the ivory trade now. You know, how long before Boko Haram starts trading in cocaine to, you know, oil? And you look at that, and it's just it's empty spaces wherein militants with their extra money, their extra organization can fill in. So it's like cracks in the wall, and they just come pouring in. I asked this of Doral Hodges on our first episode, and I'll ask you, what do you think, from everything you've seen, your perspective on the greatest security threat? Let's not say U.S., let's say in general, global security threat. Doral Hodges brought up Pakistan, which, you know, after discussion almost seems like if a government collapsed, it's like Syria on PCPs because chemical weapons versus nuclear weapons going loose. Your perspective, global security threat, and if you want to take it to the U.S. in particular, we'll talk about that. What do you think?
I think Pakistan always is the nightmare waiting to happen.
Yeah.
That's always true. Because, you know, if it ever is the case that the government were to collapse and some of those nuclear stockpiles works, but I mean, that is absolutely terrifying. I gotta say, I think that the thing looming on the horizon here that is gonna be really, could potentially be really difficult and get really ugly and spread is the Iranian nuclear program.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, we're getting to a point where all the uranium is there just waiting to be spun up, you know, just that much more, and very, you know, within months or weeks, Iran could have nuclear weapons. And Israel is being very, very clear about the fact that if they get there, they're going, whether we're coming or not. And the other folks that have been, you know, they're not as vocal about it, but, you know, the Saudis are already apparently talking to the Chinese about nuclear development. Those guys are not going to let, you know, those Arab countries in the Gulf are not going to sit there and watch Iran get nuclear weapons and not do anything about it. Whether that's getting some of their own or something else. And I think that could really blow things up in a really bad way. And I don't see how the United States, in a situation like that, is going to just stand back and watch it happen. I really don't see it. So
that's true.
I do hope that something comes out of this whole diplomatic process, but I would count myself a pessimist on that.
Yeah. Okay, because that was going to be my next question is, I look at it, and maybe I'm an optimist, but I see the nuclear weapons program as sort of like the hostage. Once you kill the hostage, what's the point? And I guess that's my hope, is I actively look for the way that everything doesn't become horrible.
Yeah.
But I'm assuming that you look at it and you say, yes, they are pursuing a nuclear weapon, and not, this is a political tool to not only build dominance against, not dominance against, but political capital against the West, and at the same time have a negotiation point. Because that's kind of how I hope it's going down. I say think it's going down, but I think I'm, in some points, trying to convince myself.
I don't think that the, you could say about North Korea that the, this nuclear weapons program has given them constant negotiation points and allowed them to do all that kind of stuff. And that's,
life is also horrible, so.
Yeah, might make you angry. But I don't think, I mean, there's nothing that suggests to me that Iran is doing this as a way of provoking negotiations on other things. The only reason right now we're getting into this series of negotiations is because they have a new president who realizes that if they don't get some of the sanctions off their back real soon, they're going to be dealing with major problems back home.
Do you see President Rouhani as a legitimate window to negotiation and change? I mean, everyone's got their fingers crossed.
The negotiation, yes, to change, no.
Okay, so you think that it's a Trojan horse?
Well,
they negotiate it with us while we secretly continue.
I think he's willing to negotiate some things, but at the end of the day, they're not going to negotiate their way. They're not going to negotiate out of having a nuclear program that would keep them in range of a nuclear weapons breakout. I don't think that they're going to do that.
Because that is the bizarre part about their language. They talk about getting a nuclear weapon, and then they talk about, oh, our weapons program, or not weapons program, let's already see my bias there, is they like, oh, my nuclear program is only for peace. And I was like, well, what happens if he finds that political middle ground? Well, hey, I never talked about a nuclear weapons program. I get to keep my nuclear program. Because, I won't lie, nuclear power is awesome. Yes. But
well, if I may channel a bit of BB Netanyahu on this, I mean, I do think it's really hard to sit there and say that their nuclear program is just for peaceful purposes. We see no need to build our civilian nuclear plants under mountains where they can't just hit my bombs. But Iran does.
It's even
easy to do that. We're not actively developing intercontinental.
Yeah.
They're developing intercontinental ballistic missiles, which have no purpose other than to carry.
That's
very difficult for me to believe that they're just sitting there really hoping that they don't want to use oil anymore and want to, do stuff.
Yeah, it's difficult to believe, but you so desperately want to.
I
wish we could all just make some money and stop pissing me off, Iran, but, yeah, I mean, you're probably right. It's just not going to happen.
So I'm waiting. I'm waiting for, whatever this breakthrough moment is going to be. I hope that it happens, but the other thing I worry about is that, if we do get to this point, what is it that we're going to do about it? Because that's another set of options for us.
That's true, and that's a whole, we talk about Syria, and we're like, oh, I don't know, Syria, it's going to be a mess. Iran is a big, heavily populated place. Like, I don't think people, maybe people do, but Iran is huge. Not that that should be a deterrence to,
no.
If you have your line in the sand and you say something, I mean, it's, having legitimacy is important, and there are certain things that are dangerous, but you're like, man, I just don't, can of worms that you've got to open, but you just are not looking forward to it.
A red line on chemical weapons in Syria has nowhere near
of
the
course
that a red line on nuclear weapons has for Iran.
And I think the people who have said, to be fair, the people like, hey, our actions in Syria undermine our I don't think anyone confuses Iran and Syria. Syria is a mess with two sides that the United States you've got Al-Qaeda on one side, you've got Assad on the other. No one wants to get involved with really either of those groups. Maybe you've got some moderates that are unfortunately in the middle of all this, but no one's confusing that with Iran. And I don't think Iran confuses itself with Syria, and I think the people who say, hey, by letting this red line pass, to a point, we did set a red line, but on the other side, I don't think anyone's conflating the two.
Yeah.
Maybe I'm wrong.
There were some people in the diplomatic community and in the governments in the Middle East who I think were a bit disturbed by that, that we went that far to say it. And there were a lot of people behind the scenes that then sort of were questioning folks from our government about, well, you still mean it about Iran, right?
Yeah.
And you're still going to be there. And I think that the president himself came out and when he made a statement about the diplomatic agreement with these chemical weapons in Syria, said, like, you know, let me be clear, Iran is not the same thing. I mean, we are not going to allow that to happen. So I think everyone understands that we're serious about it. The question is now, we seem to have a bit of a different target for negotiations than the Israelis do. I mean, my reading of what happened this week was that we seem open to some kind of civilian nuclear capability for them if they just verify certain things.
It's reasonable. Yeah, I mean, it's like...
Yeah, but Israel is cheap. They should not have it at all.
I mean, I see where they're coming from. They are in direct... Yeah. They see themselves with an existential threat of the Iranians, and with the dealings that they've constantly had, it's, do I trust them with anything? And the answers for the Israelis will always be, and a justified no.
They have a different calculation than we do.
Yeah.
They can't let them have any of it.
It is not as close for us as it is for the Israelis, and I'm not saying whether or not our point or their point is correct. You know, and again, it goes back to what you and I were saying is, what do you think the Iranian calculation is? But, I mean, you have to respect where they're coming from. And you can't really argue with it. And you're like, you're right there. And statements have been made in the past. Now, you know, President Rouhani has made not explicit statements to Israel, but at least he's not as often anti-Semitic or genocidal as...
In his rhetoric, no.
Which is important. I mean, that's a rhetoric exists for a reason. They say stuff for a reason. You just hope that they mean it. Are you going to the Defense Entrepreneurs Forum next week?
I don't.
Oh, damn. So everybody knows that is in Chicago. It's going to be a group of commercial and defense types talking about different innovations and technology. That's unfortunate. I was hoping you'd go, yes, and we'd go, oh, man, I didn't even know that. We can hang out. But since, yeah, it's, I mean, Chicago, it's not bad. Now, before we close out here, since we're talking about innovations, technology, your favorite new, we'll call it maritime. We've talked a lot about land stuff and foreign policy. So since this is ostensibly a maritime, favorite new development in maritime security technology.
Well, I have to say I'm glad to see that we are working on that long-range anti-ship missile and that we've had a couple of successful tests now. I think that if you look at the Asia-Pacific, I had a discussion with a naval gentleman in the Pentagon about this, that we don't have much in the way of anti-ship missiles anymore.
Yeah, we have Harpoon, and I think maybe I'm a bad swo if there's something else, but it's Harpoon.
It hasn't been an emphasis, but it's just, quite honestly, we haven't been thinking about navies.
We always depend on air. We've got a lot of air guys. We look at a carrier, we say, hey, why do I need a lot of anti-ship missiles when I've got aircraft that can run constant sorties?
Right, and we haven't even really been thinking about even a lot of missiles, even
Tomahawk is shit now.
We've kind of been doing that, so I'm glad to see that we're at least giving that some more thought, and that we're moving in a positive direction on that. Because I think that down the road, that's definitely a capability that we're going to need to have.
Excellent. All right. All right. So just to sum up some stuff for you listening, if you're interested, this week is African Navy's Week. We have that from 7 to 13 October. Sacred Cows Week is coming from 4 to 8 November, so that's things that you think we take for granted. Next week, I will be at the Defense Entrepreneurs Forum in Chicago, so if you have any questions or anything you want to ask, or if you'll be there, let me know. We just talked about tech. Have you seen, Dustin, USNI has an Unmanned Maritime Systems Essay Contest? Have you seen that?
I did see the contest, yeah.
Any thoughts, or are you if you're writing for it, you know, hey, never mind. But
No. I was thinking about giving that some thought. I don't know. I do not pretend to have near the brilliance of the people that enter those essay contests for your
time. I am pretty brilliant, thank you. I thought that was an interesting one because it specifically targets – now, I talk about tech. You talk about tech. Technology is way more fun, but this one's more of a, hey, how does the culture change? And you're like, man, I don't want to talk about that. Can I talk about, like, robots with, like, knife hands? Like, that sounds way cooler, but
And you saw DARPA's new galloping
– Yes, where it gallops on – they always have it on a treadmill, and now it's all by itself. And just put a bayonet on it, and it runs across the field, just living nightmare robot.
Yeah.
Since we're on the topic, any thoughts? Not Navy or military cultural change necessary? Because for me, there's not going to be any changes until we embrace autonomy. Until we embrace autonomy, there might be a few things, but really, when it comes to remote systems, it seems like more of the same. There's still a person in the loop. You're really just taking the platforms you would fly, and you're putting a human being behind it. Maybe it means more defense of the EW realm, but
yeah.
I wonder how much of a – is there really going to – until autonomy is something that we're really putting on the table, if there's going to be much of a culture shift, unless it's just more IT.
I think the one thing, you know, when you talk about any unmanned system, I think the potential problem that comes about is that there's now a much lower barrier to using force at a leadership level.
That's true.
At a decision-maker level, because people will view it as sort of cost-free, because they don't need to be worried about it, and, well, if no one's going to get killed doing this, then, it's, you know, there's not as much of a problem for me. The issue is that going forward, and actually, I mean, not even going forward, like now, we're not the only country that is using drones. We're not the only ones building robotic systems. And so, how are we going to feel about it in the future when
someone takes a step past where we are?
Next country starts, you know, well, we're going to use our unmanned systems to do this, that, and the other thing that that we really don't like. What's the code of conduct going to be about when we're allowed to use these things when we're not, you know?
Did you listen to the Intelligence Squared debate on the use of drones? They actually brought that up. They said, hey, how would, you know, let's say Iran comes up with a drone and all of a sudden it's drone striking its neighbors. Not to say, I believe in American exceptionalism, obviously, and I think that we are allowed to take certain liberties when it comes to things like the global war on terror, because you can't really argue Al-Qaeda is murdering people everywhere. But then it's like, well, it's the difference between the objective truth, which is I'm doing something that's legitimate, versus the relative truth of what kind of legal precedents have you seen? And it's just like Professor Arendt back at Georgetown talking about international law being real and all of us going, no, that's dumb. And then at the end of the day, you know, it is something. I think in Unrestricted Warfare, the Chinese authors called it like lawfare or something like that, where essentially it's using your own precedents against you.
Yeah. And I don't know how much of it is a, you know, strictly international law question or some kind of academic subject, but it more gets into sort of generally what is the precedent, and then, you know, when you're dealing with other militaries, whether at a mil-mil level or at a diplomatic level, you know, the way these things can be used, I mean, could potentially be, you know, seen for conflict.
Yeah.
So, be careful about that. I think you have to remember that, yes, it may be true that there's not an American serviceman that's being put in danger to, you know, in conducting some type of manned attack, but that doesn't mean that there isn't something tremendously important happening on the other side of that.
Exactly. Yeah. Do you watch Parks and Rec?
I've seen a bit of it.
There's a great scene and it makes me think of the way I wish America could do business. Is it's Ron Swanson, you know, the character with the mustache. Just everybody's like favorite character goes into a park and he's like, sir, you can't be bar. The cop comes up, sir, you can't barbecue here. And he's like, don't worry, I have a permit. Hands a piece of paper. He's like, sir, this just says I do what I want. And he's just looking at him like, yeah. Like, there you go. Like, hey, you can't do that. And I'm like, I have a permit. And they're like, this is just I do what I want written in crayon. And you're like, yep, that's what's up.
Yeah.
Go.
It's dicey.
Do you have anything that you want to plug? Obviously, we've mentioned Real Clear Defense, which is realcleardefense.com. You guys have a Twitter handle?
Yeah, it's at @RCDefense.
At RC Defense. And yours?
I'm just Justin R. Walker.
Justin R. Walker. Yep. Anything else that you want to bring up and plug?
Well, just check out the site we do. We do two updates a day. We bring together pretty much the best of the news and analysis and commentary on all the stuff in one spot. And then you go to the website, realcleardefense.com. You can sign up for Morning Recon, which is the morning notes. It brings everything in it. It's free. You can read everything in there. It gives you all the news you need every morning.
Perfect. And if you are listening to this and you are a writer for SimSec, that makes your life easier because instead of running around and trying to find articles, Dustin Walker and Real Clear Defense bring them to you every morning. I am Matthew Hipple. I am the host of Sea Control. You can find me at America Hipple. And if you want to find us at SimSec on Twitter, that is at SimSec. And, of course, you can always email me at nextwar@simsec.org, and you can find us at simsec.org. That is spelled C-I-M-S-E-C. Thank you, Mr. Walker. It has been a joy having you.
My pleasure. Excellent.